Welcome to the Historical Records, where we will be discussing the most recent episodes of Star Trek Discovery, the Vulcan Hello, and the Battle of the Binary Star System. I am Javon of the House Donyi Shonche, CEO of the Crimson Fury. I'll be joined today by my co-host.
I am Jorn of House Vampire, the XO of Phoenix Rising.
I am Kur of the House of Lunkij, commander of the Dark Moon Fleet.
So Star Trek Discovery is a CBS television series, and it should be noted here that this actually is the first time that CBS has started doing a Star Trek series. In the past, it's always been Paramount or Lucy Liu that's done the Star Trek series. So it's interesting to see what new ideas, new ways of doing things CBS comes up with. It has been said about Star Trek that every now and again, they have to change things. They have to rattle the fans. They change the ships. They change the uniforms. They change the look of alien races. And they even change the way you get to view them in that they go to a for-pay model. And all the stuff I mentioned is stuff that we saw in Star Trek The Motion Picture. So now that we see it again with Star Trek Discovery, is it really all that new?
No.
I think we should just address the elephant in the room. What do you think of the new Klingons?
I like the new spaceship. It's big and it's got plasma torpedoes. I guess that's what it was.
I don't really get a good look at the new ships on the series itself. I've had to go out to the web and see pictures of the ship. They just don't come across very clearly in the episode itself.
I agree with that. I can't really comment on the outside of it because when I was watching it, they just kind of looked like shapes. There wasn't really much. I couldn't really see much of it. The inside of it, I really like. And I don't actually mind the new makeup. I don't know why they felt they had to change it. I was under the impression that these guys were like a different sect of Klingons, but after watching those two episodes, this just seems like that's just the way Klingons are going to look. The makeup's cool, but I just don't get why they felt they had to change it.
One thing I noticed about the makeup is there were many shots and angles where I didn't really notice that they weren't what I expected or what we'd seen before kind of thing. A lot of the angles where you're just looking straight on, they just look like Klingons without hair. They're darker, but there's also some variety.
There's talk online of the variety, and you've got the very, very dark black, you've got a purple, and you've got an albino. And while the albino seems to be an outcast, at least based on the way the great houses addressed him, it's still there.
Right. It was a very interesting, like when T'Kuvmar talks to Volk and says he's a mirror, he sees him himself, and he speaks about his color and says, you know, some people may call your color unnatural, but he fully accepts him and welcomes him into his house because he doesn't care. As long as he's a Klingon, his appearance is irrelevant.
It was only the other great houses that were giving him a hard time.
Right. And then it was mainly Cole, I think, is who gave him the most grief.
I believe he was the one that had to turn around and not follow the main character in this episode, wasn't he?
Right. The other two houses follow what he says and go along with it. But the other two houses that speak, I think, there's like the House of Dagor and the House of Mokai.
I was almost hoping that we would hear from some of the houses that we've come to know through Star Trek.
Well, that's only three houses that we know out of 25, and these are just the great houses. I assume because there's great houses, there's also minor houses, and of that, there may be thousands.
See, I didn't think about that. They make a reference to how they've been gone for 100 years and now they're back. Do you think that maybe during Enterprise time, these guys were already gone and now they're just coming back? And this might be a way to make Enterprise make sense and also make what Kirk said in the first episode of Klingons about 10 years ago, they appeared and it was war.
I think what we saw, what we witnessed, may have been that one of the things that Picard mentions, like he says, when we first met the Klingons, there was a big thing, terrible war. I don't remember the exact line, but that's what we're seeing right here is after 100 years or so of not knowing anything about the Klingon Empire and thinking it's in disarray, I hope they explain what was meant by the Empire was in disarray, because at the time of Enterprise, that was not the case. So something's happened between the end of Enterprise and now that caused the Empire to fall apart, all of these houses to fracture, I'm assuming get into battle with each other. And then T'Kuvma shows up, lights the signal. They all show up and go, okay, what's happened? And he goes, look, I'm going to just attack the Federation because they're an insidious force that's trying to convert us from being Klingons into Federation people. And so boom, 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 boom. And then a war has begun.
Do we think there's a possibility that we might see, because they address it in Enterprise, the smooth heads and the ridges, do we think there's a possibility we might see other types of Klingons on top of these ones that maybe the great houses took off when the virus came about, and this, and maybe we'll see the smooth heads?
Maybe. Part of me hopes so. I kind of assume that the great houses are the ones that they look, you know, the way they look down at Volk because he just had white skin. I assume look down on the smooth heads just as badly, like if not worse, because, oh, you pretty much look like a human. And that to me maybe is it could be a trigger for T'Kuvma's actions, because he's seeing a big chunk of the Empire is now wandering around looking like humans, acting like humans, and he wants to remain Klingon. Well,
and we really didn't see anybody from the other ships other than the heads of the households, so we don't know who's staffing their particular ships. The smoothhead slash highborn citizen Klingon has been a staple of the literature ever since it was introduced in the motion picture.
Changing gears a little bit, what'd you guys think about the props that they had, either armored or just the weapons that they used? And do you think that sword that they're passing around, do you think that's the new Bat'leth?
Yeah, that's the new Bat'leth. It was posted online somewhere that was the new Bat'leth. I like the way the stuff looks. You know, it's got Picard all over the place. It's different, but it looks okay.
Like what I've said in the past about the J.J. Abrams Bat'leths, I don't see either these or that particular Bat'leth as being a practical weapon. It's got a lot of downsides to it.
The way that he that T'Kuvma gives Bok the Bat'leth suggests to me that it was a ceremonial thing. But he was the other torchbearer was wielding one on the hull of the ship. So
sorry, I was just going to say, I get the impression that this particular Bat'leth, at the very least, he refers to it as to like a family weapon or a house weapon. I forget the exact term he used. And I wonder if maybe we'll see, like, regular Bat'leths would just be like generic, you give them to everybody, but each house has like this old one that's been passed down throughout the years.
Right. The way I compare it is, if you compare Bat'leth to guns, how many different types of guns are there? It's just styles of gun. You know, a gun can be anything from a small little tube with a, you know, a hammer and a lever to a big thing that you sit on and you go daka 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 with. You know, it there's a whole slew of different designs, and so I assume that is with Bat'leths as well. There's a whole slew of different kind of Bat'leths, and the Bat'leth that we see in the Next Generation and later on, that's just what's become like a standard Bat'leth. That's, you know, they have a machine that just stamps them out of sheets of metal, and they just hand them to people and go, here you go, here's your Bat'leth, get on the ship.
Well, the problem I have, you talk about the analogy with guns, but basically, no matter what type of gun it is, it all does the same thing. It fires a projectile. A sword does multiple things. A sword can thrust. A sword can slash. A sword can hack, depending on how it's designed. I'm seeing these current Bat'leths as just being pokey things, just being thrusting type weapons.
Well, that's fine. The Romans conquered most of the world with pointy weapons that they went pokey, 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 pokey with, and people die. So, you know, that's a valid kind of sword.
But the Roman gladius was also a hacking weapon.
But until you actually pick it up and wield it, it may also have like some kind of energy thing in it. It may be part sword, part, you know, power weapon of some sort.
I feel like in a time where you can fire energy weapons, that the swords are probably more ceremonial than anything else. So they might not meant to be particularly useful. Like, you could use, obviously you could stab somebody with it if you really want to, but I don't know if that Batliff is meant to actually be used in combat as much as we would think, and more it's might be for like ceremonial battles maybe.
It may be that it's useful when you're wielding it in zero G, and that's why he took it outside with him, because it's like, oh, I could, you know, if I hit you with this and just cut your suit just a little bit, then bam, and it's better than a weapon that I might shoot and accidentally hit one of my coffins, and I don't want to disrupt one of those. Or
if we go back to the Klingons of Star Trek in the past, I don't really know how to say it, pre-Discovery, they had a disdain, according to the literature, for using disruptors. They preferred hand-to-hand, get-in-your-face combat.
Just to clarify that, when you're saying before Discovery, you're referring to Enterprise era, or are you referring to the Klingons that would be existing at this time based off of novels around TOS?
Before Discovery was produced. TOS, TNG, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, and the other novels that are produced.
Okay.
If you look at the Gorkon series, IKV Gorkon series, they are trying to settle their disputes in a circle of honor, hand-to-hand, face-to-face combat.
Yeah, we don't know at this point, I guess, whether or not the Klingons of the Discovery era are into that kind of honor thing. Maybe that's part of what's going on, is the houses are ununited for some reason, and T'Kuvma wants to unite them. You know, maybe they're ununited because they've fallen out of using honor, or some of them have and some of them haven't.
Well, he's trying to pull them together in the name of Kalis, so yeah, your analysis may be valid.
Well, he was trying to pull them together in the name of him, because he thought he was the reincarnation of Kalis.
Yeah, that was pretty cool when they started chanting his name and the Unforgettable.
T'Kuvma Lijlach Betbor Vi.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're starting to talk about their chanting. What do you think of the use of their use of language in this particular storyline?
Dunku. I think it's great. I love hearing Klingon.
Have we ever established in this podcast how well you speak Klingon?
Just Shofbet. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think we've had a Klingon language podcast yet.
Well, maybe this would be a good time just to establish that so people know where you're coming from when you make these comments.
I guess the best way is just I've been speaking or studying Klingon for 20 years, 20-something years. I don't know. I don't remember. I've done a number of works over the years. I provided translations for the Klingon Pop Warrior, Gen Bomb. I translated a Klingon Christmas Carol. I've done a few things for Big Bang Theory, and I worked on comic for IDW, although most of the translation of that was done. I did a lot of the Picard work on that. Most of the translation was done by Roger Chesbrough. He did a really good job on that. But my big thing was always Picard and trying to get Picard to get used in lots of places and try to get into Unicode and make it easy to use on a PC. And I'm really glad to see Picard being used properly, or at least the way in Discovery. And so that really adds another dimension to the whole language element.
For those of you that don't understand, Picard is the Klingon lettering, not John Luke.
Not Picard, Picard.
So we could safely assume that if you say the use of language in the show is pretty good, then it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's very good. It's all been translated by Robin Stewart Cole, who's a member of CAG. She and the Klingon Language Institute. She did all the translation stuff, and she's one of the, if not probably one of the best speakers in the world right now. And so she's been working on that, I think, for the past year or so. So what did you think of it? You keep asking us questions, but you're not telling us your opinion. What did you think of the way the stuff looks?
Oh, geez, I really like it. I like that they're actually using Klingon, and it seems like he's actually breaking into English. This is probably just a minor thing that's bugged me, but you think in the movies that if somebody's speaking another language, they could sense at it, to have them like talking one language quietly, and then over top you have it so their lips don't match up to it. It's a weird thing, but you think in the movies they could afford to do that. I get it, in the TV series they don't bother. But other than that, I really liked it. I really like Doug Jones and his alien costume. I didn't realize like he's like on these stilts to make it look like he has hooves. That's really cool. I love the ship designs. that there is one actor who is not in either of these episodes. And at the end of it, I was like, wow, that was just like a TV movie just stood on its own. Like it almost feels like it, like besides being the events that set the rest of the season in motion, it almost feels like it's disconnected in a way, because it's almost like a TV movie rather than the first two episodes of a TV show, which I really liked that was that style. The special effects were great. I loved the whole outer space thing. I don't know. I don't have too many complaints. Like, it looked great. I acknowledged the complaints about people saying the Klingon actors seem kind of wooden in their delivery of Klingon. I can't really blame them trying to speak a different language while you're trying to act through that much prosthetics. Can't imagine it's easy.
Just trying to learn to, you know, speak a language that's not your own is a lot of hard work to start off with. But there were several points in it where, as a Klingon speaker, I was really like impressed by the delivery. There's one line where T'Kuvmar walks up to Red Jack's brother, who is basically refusing to become the torch bearer. And he says, "Bekuvha," and he pauses. And then he says, "Ermoch nech," and which the subtitles kind of try to stay along with it, but in the Klingon, when you first hear it, it says you are dishonored, and then it becomes you are dishonoring yourself. By with the pause there, it shows that he understood. You'd have to know the Klingon to know where to pause.
And there's another thing about these actors using actual Klingon in Next Generation and DS9, a lot of the writers had to write Klingon words and make them up so that the words were pronounced readable by the actors rather than them being the words that Mark Okrand wanted to use.
Well, in TNG, if you hear Mark Okrand talk, and he often talks, we'll talk about that, he has some stories from Paramount when he was back working there. And one of them was they had this room in Paramount lot that had like copies of every single Star Trek book and resource and stuff like that in it, so that the writers could come use it. And Mark was on the set or on the lot one time, and the guy who ran that department showed Mark the room, and in it there was a bunch of Klingon dictionaries. And then a couple of days later, the guy calls up Mark and says, "All your dictionaries are gone." And because the writing staff came in and took all the copies of the Klingon dictionary to help them write an episode. So they used the resources, and sometimes, you know, they got pretty close. But then, even though they got the translation, you know, close or even right, once they passed it to the actors, they didn't actually teach them how to speak it. So they then it would get butchered at that point. But then there are other times where they just, you know, they wrote things. They didn't use the grammar. They just took from the words. They just flicked to the back of the book and wrote it using English. And then there's other times, the reason we have a serpent worms as a food, kar, is because they looked up the word for serpent, comma, worms, war, comma, worm, and went, oh, serpent worm, and just took that as a whole thing instead of it being the word for a serpent or a worm.
That's interesting, because I got the books, but I barely got through French in high school, so learning Klingon is not really an option for me. So it's interesting to hear somebody who actually understands the language, to hear them comment on the show's usage of it.
To tell you the truth, I French in school as well. It was the one course that I failed in my high school.
And Chris knows how much trouble I'm having trying to memorize the words, but if you put some effort into it and use a tool like Memorize, you can catch a word or two in the dialogue the Klingons are using, and you can understand what they're saying just a little bit.
I've been working on a transcription of the dialogue in Discovery, the Klingon dialogue. I've watched it several times now, over and over, just listening to the Klingon and comparing it to what I have written. And it really, after a while, like reading it and listening to it, it becomes clearer and easier to hear. And that practice is really helping, especially with the multiple different accents.
And as we were talking about earlier today, if you can get Discovery on Netflix, they've got it subtitled in Klingon all the way through. And I believe, Chris, you said it was the Klingon teacher from Germany, Levin Letar, that did the translation for Netflix?
Yeah, that's my understanding. He also helped them out with some commercials as well.
That is awesome.
And I highly recommend Levon's YouTube channel if you want to pick up the pronunciation of some Klingon words. He does a really good job.
Yeah, he does a good job. on that. So back to...
They kept the Death Hall! Yay!
Yeah, they did. That was interesting.
I thought it was interesting that they put their coffin around the ship like extra layer of armor.
In fact, wasn't it in the past, when we looked at Klingons and their mythos, that once the body is dead, it is a shell, and they just jettison it. They don't bother to entomb it. They don't bother to recover it. The soul, the Klingon, has gone on to Stovokor, so the shell doesn't matter anymore.
Well, that might be their practice in the TNG and DS9 era, but we're talking about houses that have isolated themselves for at least 100 years, the older houses. And there's, like, obviously, just here on Earth, not every culture buries their body or deals with it in the same way. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the Klingons would be the same.
We have a couple of things.
Well, I hope to go through and explain that particular concept, because it became a plot point in the resolution of Battle at the Binary Star.
Yeah, we have some... I know what you mean, that the Federation bombed a corpse. Isn't that like a breach of the Geneva Convention? Are you allowed to bomb your enemies and booby-trap your enemies dead?
I wouldn't know about that, but that it did seem like a pretty underhanded move, especially for the battle actually being over. Like, the Klingons had clearly given up and were just going to leave, and then they continued the fight by planting a bomb on when they're dead. I feel like this is something that would extremely piss off the Klingons later.
Right. To me, that's desecration of the dead. You know, that's, I don't know if that's an ethical thing to do.
But my point was that based on the Klingons of TNG and DS9, that could not have happened. They would not have recovered the dead and the bomb.
Right. I understand what you're suggesting, implying that perhaps this event is what caused the change in Klingon practices. You know, Star Trek IV gave us the Klingon mummification glimpse. Deep Space Nine has an episode where Worf sits and watches a corpse, because there was some Klingon tradition that says that they would sit and watch corpses. So maybe that's connected to it in some way. And then I think there's something in Voyager as well that...
I always got the impression that Worf kind of made that up to justify him staying with O'Brien, because Worf wasn't really known for liking to admit that he was wrong about stuff.
Before watching Discovery, I would have gone along with that suggestion. But now with Discovery suggesting that there was, at least at some point in the Klingon history, a time where they collected their dead, perhaps there could have been a time on Klingon when, you know, when if someone was fallen while they were hunting or something like that, someone would keep watch of the body so that they could take it back and perform these rites and put them in a coffin and seal them away.
That's fair. I did not get that immediately after I said it.
So it would be nice if they'd throw us a bone and give us a quick explanation.
I'm hoping they will. We don't know. They did explain some stuff, but...
I don't think explanation's needed for that. It's just over time, their culture's changed.
I would prefer they don't make it a blatant, the reason that those Klingons look different, sir, is because of blah, 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 blah. I'd much prefer that they just kind of explain it through storytelling without, like, smacking you in the face with it kind of thing.
Even something as simple as just the next time they don't collect their bodies, I think that would infer enough that they're not doing it because of what the Federation did. Man, now that you point out, that was really a dick move.
Yeah, that's not... I'm pretty sure that there's some, you know, code of war that says you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to desiccate the corpses of your enemies.
But I'm pretty sure if we go through military history, we'll find that in almost every epoch, armies have done that.
Oh, I'm sure armies do it, but I think there are, at a time when people thought it was, they could create civilized war, they wrote these kind of things where they said, oh, okay, you shouldn't do this, you should treat prisoners of war as, you know, treat them well. We know there's plenty of countries that have not treated prisoners of war well, and so if the United States had somebody was killed during a war and their body was retrieved, it wouldn't be desecrated. It would probably be buried, even though there was an enemy of some sort. Even criminals, I think, get buried.
I was going to say, as far as I know, they do. Most of the time, they just get cremated.
Probably, but even prisoners that we execute, most parts of the world, I guess, have some kind of respect for the dead, even the dead of enemies, as long as it's, you know, a civilized war as opposed to an uncivilized war. I don't know.
Is there such a thing as a civilized war?
I don't know. I think there was a time when people thought they could have a civilized war, you know, where you line up on one side and you line up, troops line up on the other side and they just run at each other and that's your war and you just fight. Nowadays, it's with bombs and stuff. It's not really possible. Planes and ICBMs and stuff.
But you're right, though. Burial rites and burial customs have changed throughout human history, but they've changed with the culture and they reflect something of that culture. Look at ancient Egyptians and how they did things. Go into the Middle Ages and how they did things. And then look at us today and how we treat the dead. All of that stuff says something about what particular culture you're looking at. So hopefully we'll see something. If the Klingon burial range over time change.
Was the Federation a direct call about how the Federation endeavors to convert cultures to its way of thinking?
Which would be should they choose to use that?
I have not read anything about any other, what's the word?
Speculation.
Yeah,
trailer, though, at the end of episode 2, it looks like we're basically a changes that over the course of the next several episodes.
Yeah, I think it's more of a prelude than a prequel. And then, yeah, the next episode, I'm wondering how much of a time gap there's going to be based on what's said in the little trailer for the next episode. It seems to have been some time and some kind of war has started, which I assume is a war with the Klingon.
It does look pretty immediate, doesn't it?
Yeah, from the cover of the trailer, it almost looks like she goes straight to Discovery, but who knows, there might be 6 months or a year or two before they decide to grab her.
See, that's the thing. I don't think she's going to go straight to Discovery. She's going to go to jail. And I think Discovery, they spring her somehow. They do a Tom Paris kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the impression I'm getting too. We actually joked about, me and the wife joked about that immediately after the episode, that Janeway's going to come in and spring her.
Jason Isaacs, a.k.a. Janeway?
Yes.
I wonder what he's going to look like in the wig.
You know, it kind of reminds me of Blake Seven.
Blake Seven?
Blake Seven is set up by, Blake is going to prison on a prison ship. They have to go over and check out an alien ship, and that's how they get the Liberator and start the series. In this case, we were looking at it almost in the trailer. To me, it looked like Michael was being transported to whatever penitentiary she was going to stay at by the Discovery, and that particular captain decides to hang on to her. But then we're speculating based on trailers.
Did either of you guys catch After Trek?
I like half watched it. It was James Fran was funny.
I think it's interesting. He's not the guy who does the Talking Dead, but him and Chris Hardwick do a podcast together called The Nerdist. So it's interesting to see Matt Myra doing that now, doing an After Trek show himself.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him.
He also does podcasts where him and his buddy didn't really watch a lot of Star Trek, and he watched all of it. And they're going through Next Generation. It's called The Next Conversation, just one episode at a time.
Oh, like his friend watches it, and then they come over and talk about it?
Yeah, that's basically the entire podcast.
So what did you think of the special effects, specifically at this point, the space battles?
They remind me a lot of the Kelvin universe, which is people have been using that as more of a complaint rather than a positive. I thought the space battles looked cool. Kind of hard to keep track of what was happening at one point, but kind of figured it out after a while.
I thought it was a little dark. Hard to tell what was going on. Like I said earlier, you couldn't really get a good view of any of the Klingon ships based on how dark it was.
I think you need to turn your brightness up, because when I was watching it earlier, the scene where all the Klingon ships like warp in to the middle of the battle, it's like boom, 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 and then they all start shooting. You can see them really well. And there's a couple of different styles.
Well, I know with me, it's just a streaming issue, because I have to watch it. The streaming I'm getting, I think it might be an issue with my computer, because when I watch on my Apple TV, it's not that bad. But we're watching on the computer and I have to drop the streaming level down just so it wouldn't stop every 5 minutes on me.
Well, that sucks.
Yes, it does. It's kind of annoying.
Which is a problem with streaming.
I'm just going to have to buy a new Apple TV. That's about it. Not that I'm really complaining. I wanted a new one anyway.
Yeah, the CBS stream is smooth. Like I watch it on my laptop, and I had it on the projector over the weekend, and it was really nice, really good quality. And that's the thing. I can see like the scene where the Klingon ship decloaks, and it's all green, and there was a really nice bit of CGI.
Well, hopefully once I get that strained out, I can go back and watch everything again. What do you think about the new Star Trek uniforms?
To an extent, they are an extension from, a step up from, Enterprise.
They look like, yes, looking cool.
Like the gold, silver, and bronze that separate the divisions. I thought that was a nice change from the normal stuff. Engage the podcast. And they were talking to somebody who did the press behind the scenes thing, and they showed them the photos of all the cast in the three different uniforms. There's the one that obviously made to the show, and then they did the ones from the actual series, and then they did the ones from the pilot, the cage. Like when they first started doing costumes, they using them, but they weren't sure if it would just look cheesy. I guess they decided at some point it would just kind of look cheesy, so they went with the rear. Because they have the pips on the badges now. It makes it hard to tell the ranks apart, at least with the image I'm getting. But I like how the captains and the admiral have like extra things on their uniform that tell them apart from everybody else.
You mean on their shoulders?
Yeah, and the admiral had a different badge than everybody else too. And I know some people had like a square around their badge, so I'm wondering if that means that they're like enlisted instead of officers, or maybe cadets.
Don't know. Somebody is going to have to sit down and break down the rank structure.
I wonder if they'll release it at some point, since they seem to be doing a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, maybe. They seem to be interested in being interactive with the fans. I just get that impression from them actually doing the After Trek thing. So maybe at some point it'll come up either in some sort of technical manual they release, or maybe in the After Trek show or article or something. It'd be cool just to figure it out, because it might be a little bit easier to tell them apart. It's not like those little tiny dots on the badge are just hard to see. Like I said, it might be just my stream. I don't know. Could you tell them easily apart, Quirk?
I didn't really pay that much attention. I didn't even notice that there were little squares and stuff on people's shoulders. The Klingons I could tell apart, but all those humans just look the same.
Well, frankly, only the captain and the admiral had extra stuff on the shoulders. Everybody else on the ship seemed to have the same piping. I didn't pay attention to the badges on the chest as much as Javon did.
I'm aware of the dot thing from the pip thing from that very first promotional they put out, where it was like behind the scenes photos. There was a close up of the chest and it had the pips on it. And I think we were just assuming that was how ranks were going to be told. But if they're actually using that, or if that was just I'm not sure if they're actually using it, because I couldn't see it on my screen. But it could be something that they just threw out, because I don't think in the original series that they really had a whole lot of ranks outside of captain. But what was it, Commodore, lieutenants, and stuff like that?
Commanders, lieutenant commanders, ensigns, and they were all designated by the bars or the ribbons on their sleeves.
No, I think there were more ranks in Next Generation on than there were in the original series. I don't think there were quite as many ranks.
In the original series, Chekhov started out as an ensign.
And there was yeomans as well, Yeoman Rand. It started off, it was like yeoman, ensign, lieutenants, lieutenant commander, captain, admiral. TNG introduced like chief petty officers and stuff like that, though.
And I never could really understand that, because Miles O'Brien was chief, and yet he was an officer?
Yeah, he was also an ensign as well. He gets demoted. Like, the first time he shows up, I think he's an ensign. The next time he shows up, he gets demoted. The next time he shows up, he's been promoted. Then he gets, like, demoted again. It's just they never were consistent with his pips, because he was supposed to be a background character, and then he all of a sudden became a foreground character.
That's just Picard giving out field commissions like they're candy.
Right. It's like he makes a kid into an acting ensign and lets him fly the most expensive starship in the fleet.
But he doesn't crash it.
No, but he takes it to some crazy places.
Apparently, they never let Marina Sirtis live down the fact that when they gave her command of the Enterprise, she crashed it.
Twice.
Well, she only really did it once.
But she did it so well.
We just got to see it twice, right?
Oh, I thought she was flying it too when they rammed it into Shinzon's ship.
Oh, yeah, she ran. I was thinking in Generations, we get to see it crash.
Twice.
So that's three times then.
And that's why they never let her live it down.
I think we're diverging from the topic.
Yes, we might have to cut all of that out.
Uniforms, but what about those ships? The first time we've seen a bridge on the bottom.
Oh, I heard originally I forget the name of the ship, that the ship is kind of upside down, is autographed upside down. So I wonder if maybe it kind of relates to that story. Maybe that
military ship and the bridge is in the dead center.
Military, they're explorers. They come in peace.
Aye.
about that till just now.
It's
know it.
And then there was a secondary bridge in TOS that was Jering. If you look at the Doomsday Machine.
And that was right next to the hall too?
I'm not sure. Where's engineering?
Oh, right. It was next to engineering. I think that's... But that makes... It being in the center makes sense to save the impact and to save the senior staff because most of them are sitting right there.
Yeah. So moving the bridge to the bottom of the disc is no big deal.
Yeah, and if anything, I know probably the idea is to make it seem like it's more protected, but space, like up and down is just relative to which way you're pointing at that point. So it's just as exposed as it is on top.
Which was a major plot point in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
What do you think of the ship, Quirk?
I thought it was a very interesting design. You know, it was like an upside, well, not upside down, but it was like a the Reliant style. But older. And I liked how the transporter room, they explained why the transporter room looked completely different because it used a completely different kind of transporter technology.
Yeah, I like that too. That was a cool part.
It's an old ship, but it gets her there. Interesting enough, since I first saw the design for the ship, it reminded me of the Itik.
I'm not familiar with that one.
The Vulcan pin, Infinite Diversity and Infinite Cultures.
Oh,
infinite diversity and infinite combinations.
Right, I knew it was, forgot it was cement. But it looked like that pin.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It did look a bit like that. What about the Klingon ship ramming that Federation ship?
Worf would
the
have been
oldest rather. Naval tactic in the book.
But would it have worked? That's the thing. If you bump into an object in zero G, can you plow into it like that?
If both ships are moving in the proper direction, yeah. If they're not, then you're right. They're just going to change momentum.
Right. If that one ship is stationary, the Federation ship was stationary and the Klingon plowed into it. In my mind, when the Klingon ship starts to push against the Federation ship, it would start to move backwards because there would be nothing stopping it.
Were the thrusters actually off, or was it, or were the thrusters keeping it in a holding position? Because it might have,
the only thing that the thrusters they would have to hold against would be the gravitational pull of the binary system, and that would have been pulling it towards the Klingon ship. So the thrusters would have been pushing it away from that to keep it still.
I don't know that much about it, but I imagine it might if you hit it fast enough, you're probably still going to do damage. I think it would be like slapping your hand against water, doing a belly flop. Like water usually just would go around you, but if you hit it hard enough, it's like hitting pavement. So maybe in space, it's the same thing. If you come at it fast enough, it might still do damage.
I guess it just seemed very slow.
No, if both ships would have to be accelerating. Now, the Eureka, what was it, the Eureka?
Europa, I think.
Europa. If the Europa was accelerating to stay in its position, and remember, we are talking the fact they were in a system with a binary star, so gravitational factors are going to come into play here. If it's accelerating, then when the Klingon ship plows into it, they're both accelerating, and in that case, they would stay where they're at, a.k.a. ram into each other. If they didn't need to accelerate to stay there, ramming into it would just push it away.
That's why I was thinking that if it had to accelerate in order to stay stationary to fight the gravitational pull of the stars, then yes, but I guess I'll need to rewatch it, but it looked to me like the Klingons were on the star side of them and not the other side of them.
But remember, the Europa had just tractor beamed the Shenzhou out of falling into the binary system.
Right, that's why they were moving away from it. So that's what I'm saying. I'd have to relook and see. If the Klingons are on the outside of the star system, then sure. But if they're on the inside, then it doesn't.
But if you're looking for a pure military tactic to allow being plowed in, use the tractor beam.
Yeah, the front of the ship was obviously designed for plowing into stuff. Here's another question for you guys. The cloaking devices. Did Klingons have cloaking devices at this time? Because isn't that a Romulan technology?
Well, Klingons got cloaking technology from the Romulans in TOS in third season. But they did say that this was the only ship that was able to make itself invisible. So this may be brand new technology that they're testing out.
That is a very old ship too, apparently. So maybe cloaking technology was a lost thing at some point, or maybe they stole it from, like, there's that older race that they address in Next Generation at some point.
The Herc?
yeah, maybe they stole it from maybe they found some of their technology and were able to adapt it to their own.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's how Klingons got spaceflight.
There we go. Maybe it had cloaking.
We don't know whether or not that's how Klingons got spaceflight.
But it wouldn't take a whole lot to retrofit your father's ship with a new technology if you're trying to test it out.
All right. No, it could be a new technology, but I wasn't sure if they had cloaking technology at that time or if this is some new kind of cloaking technology that's different from the Romulan one. And that's maybe what it is. This may be something that maybe the Federation figures out how to get through it, through the cloak. And that's what Discovery is all about. It's about discovering cloaking techs. No, that's silly.
Maybe before we get together to do another episode review, maybe we should try to watch that TOS episode to see what they exactly said.
That sounds like a good idea.
Which TOS episode?
I don't remember. I would have to look it up. One where they address the Klingons getting cloak from the Romulans.
Oh, that's the Enterprise incident.
Oh, thank you.
I knew Enterprise was in it, but I couldn't remember it. I was thinking tomorrow's Enterprise, but it's Enterprise incident.
I believe it's second episode, third season.
There we go. That's everybody's homework before.
Well, that's when they steal the cloaking device from the Romulans.
And the only reference to the Klingons is the fact that the Romulans are using Klingon-designed ships, and they reference it was a technology swap of cultures.
Remember them? Where there being talk that happened, but I didn't realize it was in a specific episode.
Yeah, I can't remember either, but I'm sure a quick Google search will bring something up that, if it's not that episode, it'll probably tell me which one. Anything else?
Do you think Volk the albino Klingon is related to the albino in Deep Space Nine?
I kept thinking that the whole episode. I even went back to get my copy of Excelsior Forged in Fire, which is where he pops in originally, to check it out, and it's definitely a different name. And that particular albino, according to the literature, is a genetically engineered attempt to get Ridge's back and doesn't have an albino ancestor.
That's in some random book, right?
Star Trek Excelsior Forged in Fire.
Yeah, I don't know if they consider the books canon or if they consider the books not canon.
I think it's kind of like Star Wars. It's in canon as long as the show doesn't contradict it.
Well, I mean, for the writers, the people who made Discovery said that they're making sure they're not contradicting canon. I don't know what their definition of canon is. If their definition of canon is just the live action stuff, then for them, the albino could be related to Volk because they're disregarding the book. But if their version of canon includes the books as well, then...
That's interesting. That'd be something else that maybe we should try to look into. I know a lot of the writers are on Twitter. I wonder if we tweeted at them, if they would answer that.
Probably.
So I know, like, J.J. Abrams said, like, he was like, the cartoon series is in, except for this one episode, one where Spock goes back in time.
Oh, the one with his kid where he meets himself.
Yeah, yesterday, or all your, I can't remember the name right now. But that episode makes the Moon of Vulcan continuity where originally it wasn't.
Interesting, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was a really random thing that I found out, too. That besides the exploring his youth, which was some, they drew a little bit of inspiration from it. They also wanted the moon so that they could have the shot of Spock witnessing the destruction of the planet. And that was just a drawing error, really.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and watch that episode. Another one you're talking about, it's where he gets attacked and hurt by the Selet or something?
Yeah, and it turns out he was his own uncle or cousin or something like that saved him.
Right, he saved himself, and he remembers himself saving himself, but he didn't know it was himself at the time.
Yeah. Final thoughts from me, I would like to say that I enjoyed these first two episodes. I also enjoyed After Trek. I think Matt Myra is adorable, and I look forward to seeing what they're doing. I personally don't mind paying for the streaming thing, but I don't get live TV, so... All I do is get streaming services. So I got Netflix and now I got Crave TV. So it's not a huge deal to me personally. The other side of it too is that puts on us to keep Star Trek going. Like if we really want to see it going, then we all need to sign up and pay for it. Because if people are signing up and watching Star Trek, they see that we're actually doing it. They're going to keep on making it until people stop watching it. And there's going to be no debate about what the ratings actually were or having to worry about whether or not people want to advertise their products or something like that. The money's coming directly from us, so we're the ones who are determining whether or not it's going to stay on the air.
But a lot of what I've been reading is, with this particular model, it's not going to be the Star Trek fans that save it. They're going to have to diversify out enough that they can get more than just the diehard fans that are looking for Trek, new Trek, to watch.
Yeah, for me, I agree with, I think it looks really good. The show looks good. The story is very interesting. Excited to see where it goes. Really happy to see Klingon, speaking proper Klingon on TV. That's amazing. And I don't care about the streaming thing. I don't pay for cable TV. So $6 a month. It's even less than that if you buy it in bulk. So I'm happy. But I also want to mention Starbase Indy this Thanksgiving in Indianapolis. The Klingon Assault Group will be having a big gathering there. Guests include Denise Crosby, Tasha Yar, Robert O'Reilly, Gowron, and Mark Okrand, the creator of the Klingon language. There's also Jen Bomb, the Klingon pop warrior, will be there. And Bill Hedrick, Thought Admiral Kolb, the current leader of the Klingon Assault Group, will also be there as a guest of honor. Check out their website. I think it's starbaseindy.com.org. Not quite sure. Check the links below. There'll be a link in there. They also are on Facebook. It's just Starbase Indy. Search for that. But we hope you can join us. Kapla.
Kapla.
Kapla.